Blog Talk Radio.
The topics and opinions expressed in the following show are solely those of the hosts and their guests and not those of W4CY Radio, its employees, or affiliates. We make no recommendations or endorsements for radio show programs, services, or products mentioned on air or on our web. No liability, explicit or implied, shall be extended to W4CY Radio or its employees or affiliates. Any questions or comments should be directed to those show hosts. Thank you for choosing W4CY Radio.
Is January Jones. She is not a young, beautiful, talented actress on Mad Men. She is not an older, gorgeous, exotic dancer from the Johnny Carson show. She is an author, and she wrote Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment that reads number one at Amazon.com. She is a reality TV golf personality with World High Stakes Golf televised on HDNet. She is a humorist and winologist expert. She is your featured host today on January Jones Sharing Success Stories. So sit back, relax, and get ready to laugh and listen to Ms. Jones with her eclectic roster of guests as you learn life's lessons. These stories plus sharing equals success. Welcome, and remember, beware. Because you are entering the no-whining world of January Jones.
Hello, everyone. I hope you're having a wonderful, terrific, fabulous day. I'm January Jones, and I'd like to welcome you to our podcast today. As you can see, I'm wearing one of my glitter cowboy hats. I'm getting ready to launch my new brand, Glitter Granny Gifts. I'll be doing affiliate marketing at Amazon as an associate next month. I'll be selling books and products, and we'll be telling you more about it as the date gets closer. Now for my listeners, let me ask you a question. What do you know about anxiety and depression during these troubling times? Do you think about it? I think we all do. Would you like to meet someone today who can help you deal with our global and domestic problems that are all over the world every day from the minute we wake up till the time we go to bed? The big question here that we're going to try to answer is what we can do to actively contribute to healing and transformation. Tell me, have you ever heard about an amazing book called Revolutionary Optimism? If you can answer yes or maybe to any of these questions I've asked, then you are in the right place. And I would like to welcome you to January Jones Sharing Senior Success Stories. So now it's time for you to relax, go get some cheese and crackers, and I'm welcoming you into our No Wine Zone today. Let me tell you about our guest. Our guest has written a practical handbook for anyone feeling anxiety about their life and the super crises affecting our world at this time. The book is called Revolutionary Optimism, 7 Steps for Living as a Love-Centered Activist. This book inspires the reader step by step to live the path of love and choose to actively contribute to our collective healing and our transformations. It's my pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Paul Reitz, veteran leader on the front lines of multiple global and domestic movements at this time. Hi, Dr. Paul. Welcome to the show. How are you today?
Hey, January. Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored.
Oh, we're so happy to have you. I've been looking forward to this. Before we talk about your soon-to-come-out book, which, by the way, is at Amazon now and it can be pre-ordered, I want to ask you, where did your personal success story begin? Where were you born? And tell us a little bit about your background.
Thank you for that question. I was born in Philadelphia. My parents owned a hoagie shop or a sandwich shop. And my sister and I were the first generation in our families to go to college. Okay. My parents were very smart, but they didn't have that opportunity, nor my grandparents before them, or any prior generation. So Yeah. Going to college was a great like first success for me, like getting out of the house. My parents got divorced around the time I went to college, and I lived in a bit of a cauldron of dysfunction, and there was a lot of love as well. So it was a mixed bag situation. And then I went on to medical school, and that was like a big challenge and a big opportunity to grow. And I succeeded at that. And during that time, I decided I didn't really want to do clinical medicine, or I didn't really want to see patients. I looked at the health of the population, and I was really focused on preventive medicine. How do we create human well-being, and how do we keep people healthy, vibrant, alive, during their lives, so they live fully? And I think that's the quest I'm still on.
Okay, so then. It's interesting. Our backgrounds are so similar because I'm from that first generation that got to go to college also. Mm-hmm. And we were carried on the shoulders of our wonderful immigrant grandparents and our parents who assimilated and did a magnificent job raising us. So you were a medical doctor, and then you decided not to do that. And now did you have to go for more training? You became a psychologist, I'm assuming.
No. I went on, I finished medical school, and I got specialty training in public health and preventive medicine.
Okay.
And I worked on how do you bring preventive solutions to large populations. So the first job that I had was working on global polio eradication. We were using the polio vaccine to eradicate polio. Worked in Africa, and I worked on the HIV/AIDS pandemic. And it was during that time that I realized that we had available solutions in the global north, but they were not available in Africa, Asia, and other parts of the world, the life-saving AIDS medicines. And mm-hmm. so at that moment, I had like an awakening, I would say, where I became an advocate and activist. Because I realized that you can solve problems not only from the inside of the institutions and systems, but more importantly, you can create advocacy movements on the outside that mm-hmm. can put pressure on decision makers. And that's how you get the paradigm transformation with that internal pressure.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you mentioned the polio vaccine, because what a amazing thing that was for our generation, as you probably recall, I do.
Yeah, I got smallpox, and
when that came out, my parents, we were first in line because one of my brother's friends, a 7-year-old boy, had died of polio in that time, and our family was deeply affected by it. And so my parents were so thankful to get the vaccine, and that we were able to, for our generation, pretty much eradicate the polio situation. And it was so interesting how they embraced it. And then as time goes on, when we see the reaction to the vaccines that have come out since, it's disappointing in some ways, isn't it?
Well, I think that there's been a rapid evolution of the number of vaccines. And during the COVID pandemic recently, which we all lived through, it was the most rapid development of a new vaccine ever in human history.
Yeah.
The prior example best was mumps vaccine in the 1950s. They developed that in 5 years.
Wow.
So the COVID vaccines were developed in less than a year and then deployed domestically in the United States and globally. That was a massive feat of human endeavor mm-hmm. to be able to do that. And I think that the people that are questioning vaccines, they have a legitimate perspective in terms of wanting transparency from the pharmaceutical companies and the government about what the risks are. And I think that's a legitimate advocacy effort. I believe in vaccination. I'm vaccinated. My kids are vaccinated. My grandchildren are vaccinated. I believe in preventive measures like vaccination. It's very powerful way of staying healthy.
Yeah, I know, and likewise we do. But it's interesting. So many families, ours as one of them, have people who disagree about it.
Yeah,
and it makes for such fascinating holiday dinners. So we've kind of learned that it's important to listen to everyone, mm-hmm. and to not be too judgmental. Wouldn't you say that's pretty good advice?
that is really perfect. And that's a good segue to my book, Revolutionary Optimism, The Seven Steps for Living as a Love-Centered Activist, because what you're talking about is really part of the heart of the book, which is step four, which is called peace crafting. And it's about the art of how do we relate to each other. And it's a four-step cycle. The first step is being a listening friend, like really working on being a good listener. And then second is embracing multiple points of view. Like I have my point of view, you have your point of view. People have a legitimate point of view, and we have to listen and be respectful of multiple points of view. Then the third step is, the third part of the peace crafting is using love speech, using speech that's loving in response to whatever's going on, not have to win a battle and put people down or shut people up, you know? It's love speech, empower people. And fourthly, it's about expanding truth, you know, learning how to build trust between people.
Absolutely.
I meant trust, yeah. So we have a trust-o-meter, you know, how you can go up and down in building trust with people, which is essential.
For sure, for sure. Well, right now, we're going to take a break and hear about how to stop people from whining. If you are a whiner or if you know a whiner, this would be a great gift.
Lately, there's a whining epidemic in our world. People are even whining about whining. Are you sick and tired of listening to everyone whining all the time? So was January Jones, the author of Thou Shall Not Whine, the 11th commandment that reached number one at Amazon.com. Ms. Jones based her book on a survey of the top 10 things that people whine about at all ages and all stages of life. January is a success coach that can tell you how to help others. When you buy Thou Shalt Not Whine, the 11th commandment, you'll find out what people whine about and how to stop them from whining. This is the perfect gift book to give or get for any occasion. Thou Shalt Not Whine was voted the best gift to be given anonymously for those special people in your life. Ms. Jones is an internationally known author in the style of Irma Bombeck, specializing in housewife humor with her book being published in Korea and China. You can find Thou Shalt Not Whine at Amazon.com.
Welcome back to the No Whine Zone with my guest today, Dr. Paul Reitz. He is not a whiner because he is a true winner. And Dr. Paul, would you share with our listeners your website information and some information about when your book will be available for them at Amazon?
Sure. Thank you very much. This is the book. It is available now on Amazon for pre-order, and it will be released on May 1st. My website is Dr. Paul Zeitz at .org or unifiedmovements.org is the movement that I'm working on with many others to bring about love at the center for our social, economic, and political systems.
Wow, what a wonderful movement and what a magnificent project you've been undertaken. I mean, we certainly need it. It's just amazing what's going on in the world today. The upheaval and the anxiety is shared by so many people. When you talk about your seven steps, let's go back and summarize a little bit about step one, and that's called it's go time. Now, would you explain what that is and how we can do it and learn more about it?
Yeah, so it's go time is kind of an attitude, and it's about like waking up in the morning and going, I'm alive. It's go time. You're like, get on with it. And it's about making choices about how you want to live your life, about how I live my life or how each person lives their life. So there's a set of practices in step one, which helps you understand, like, or ask the question, rather, how can I serve today?
Okay.
And there's a whole section and practices like waking up, it's go time. Okay, I'm alive. I'm still breathing. How can I serve today? And that can take many forms. It can be taking care of yourself and self-care, number one priority. It can be caring for loved ones. It could be taking action in your community or at a church or in some group that you're part of. And it can be involved in taking on the challenges of our country and our world. So we look at all four of those levels as being ways of serving. And then I ask people to imagine future generations. I invite people to imagine the future generations and look forward into the future at your children or your grandchildren or your great-grandchildren, and imagine them looking back at you and thanking you for the amazing action that you're taking today and every day. Oh, you know, so that you can really like be inspired about like we're a living legacy from the past, and we have a future ahead of us. And those future generations, there's a way of I share ideas about how you can imagine them and use that as fuel for your moving forward, and it's go time.
Oh, yeah. I don't know about you, but I have 7 grandchildren. And of course, I'm very concerned about what kind of world they're going to be in. And of course, one of my goals has been to attempt to try to grow old graciously and to try to be what we talked about before, open to all kinds of viewpoints and opinions, and help the grandchildren, because it's going to be such a difficult world for them to navigate, don't you think?
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I wrote Revolutionary Optimism. I wanted to offer the best practices from my adult life and how I have learned to generate myself as a revolutionary optimist, because I was struggling with anxiety and despair and hopelessness. You know, it's overwhelming, the day-to-day struggle of life now, plus all the crises that are going on around us. So we are going through a passage in our country and as humanity globally. And the intent of the book is to really open people up, take a breath. You can relax now. Like, okay, we have, you know, everyone shared the shared anxiety. Now we have the opportunity to breathe a little bit. There's some tools in here about how we can work together and unify ourselves to solve these local and global challenges. That's the only way we can solve them.
Well, and my next question obviously is going to be about this last pandemic that we went through.
Yes.
And what are your thoughts about how we did, how we survived it, and what we need to do in the future?
That's a great question. Thank you. The pandemic was a major global disruption. Now, of course, there's been pandemics before that humanity's had to deal with, but this was different in that it was in a globally interconnected world where we have all this media and telecommunications and global travel in an unprecedented way. 100 years ago, that did not exist, right? So the way that it spread so rapidly and the way that information spread from multiple sources, it was unprecedented. And I think the public health response got outpaced a little bit by the, you know, counterforces of misinformation. And, you know, no one ever had experience with a global pandemic in this era of global information telecommunications.
Oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of bad information that was going around. It was hard to figure out what was going on. There was a lot of what I call sense making. What's happening? Like, what's going on, you know? And so there was a lot of learning, and it was so disruptive to life, you know, all of our lives were disrupted, every single person I know. And unfortunately, I think that that was a practice run for disruption. I think that over the next decades, humanity is going to go through more disruptions, more difficulties, more challenges with the climate emergency, with the teetering of our democracy, with the economic inequality. All these things are leading to a sense of turbulence right now, or I actually feel like there's a trembling of a peaceful revolution, you know, a transformative phase that we're going to go through. You know, we have evolutionary progress, and then there are periods of time where things get ignited and there's revolutionary transformation. It feels like that's what might be going on.
Okay. You know, it's interesting because when we were hit with the AIDS, I thought, well, nothing could be worse than this. You know, I thought that was just the most horrible thing we were going to experience. And then, of course, the pandemic came. But then I was thinking about our parents, our grandparents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like when they went through World War II, that was, I think, comparable to a pandemic because it was a worldwide conflict. And I think that everyone in the world had to pull together on that. And I think the pandemic was a similar experience.
Yeah, I think it was, as the world has continued to globalize and be interconnected over, you know, since World War II, actually, you know, mm-hmm. it had that kind of global effect like World War II did. I agree with you. That was both our major disruptions. You know, yeah. We have a lot of war going on right now, the war in Ukraine, the war in Israel, Gaza, and all over Africa, there's wars. So, you know, we're in the United States, for example, we don't necessarily feel those wars directly at home unless you're military or military family, then you do really feel it directly impacting on you. But I think that the political violence here in our own country that we've seen rise in, that is creating a lot of anxiety for most Americans who don't want to see that kind of civil breakdown. That we want to get along with our neighbors. We want to love thy neighbor. We're love-centered. We're good-hearted people for the majority. So it's a challenging time.
Okay. Now your second step is self-liberation. Liberating oneself to find and act from your unique path of service. Okay, let's talk about how does one go about finding their unique path?
Yeah, thank you for this. I'm so excited to share it with you, honestly.
Good.
Self-liberation is a concept that not everyone understands, right? That you can actually liberate yourself and unleash your full potential. So even that as a concept is new for some people. And then there are practices and tools and tactics for how do you go about doing that. So one of the main ideas in step two is about understanding that we are on a journey of self-liberation into our awakened full power self, and we have to work at it. And one of the things that we have to do is work on what I call the inner dragon. There's something that's a part of human psychology, which I call the inner dragon, which is our inner judge, our inner critic, our inner saboteur, the voice that tells us we're not good enough or don't say that because you might upset other people or whatever the narratives that are going on in my mind or your mind or other people's minds. Mm-hmm. It's something that I struggled with for many, many years. And, it was like, I had like an inner conflict. Like I was like, felt like, you know, I wanted to be a loving person, but I was like, you know, being put down by myself and I was self-sabotaging, you know? So I've learned how to that's not the right word. It's about creating a peace with my inner dragon within me so that I could have inner peace.
Do you think this inner dragon perhaps, comes from your dysfunctional childhood?
I think everyone has an element of it. I had a very severe dysfunctional family. So yes, I had early childhood trauma. I'm a survivor of childhood sexual violence. Oh, so the kind of trauma that I experienced definitely created a defense system that was like very overactive, I would say. You know, yeah. I was always like in a fight or flight mode. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, but it forced me to heal myself in ways and learn, oh, I didn't even know there's an inner dragon, you know? So I had to like really, I've done a lot of work on healing modalities about how do you heal this relationship that goes on inside.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think it's not unique to me. As many people struggle with their inner dragon.
Okay, we're going to take a break now because when we come back, I want to talk about that, about how people can deal with healing. And I'm curious to know if you recommend psychiatry or what kind of practices you recommend. But before we do that, it's 60 years later and people are still wondering who killed Kennedy.
Let me ask you a question. Are you still wondering who killed Kennedy? Over 50 years later, the assassination is still a mystery. It is unfinished business for our country. Now, get ready for a theory that you've never heard before, but will make more sense than any other conspiracy theory that you've ever heard in the past. January Jones speaks the unspeakable in her book, Jackie, Ari, and Jack, The Tragic Love Triangle, connecting Jackie and Aristotle Onassis romantically prior to JFK's assassination. Did you know that Ari was Jackie's guest in the White House during the JFK funeral? He was the only non-family member who was invited by Jackie to stay there during the funeral. Aristotle Onassis was one of the wealthiest men in the world, with the means, the motive, and the money to order an assassination that was the perfect crime of the last century. Ari needed class, and Jackie needed cash. They were perfect for each other. Now, what is Camelot? It is but another tragic love triangle. Jackie, Ari, and Jack is available at JanuaryJones.com, Amazon.com, and Audiobooks.com, read by Ms. Jones.
Welcome back with my guest, Dr. Paul Reitz. His new book, Revolutionary Optimism, is coming out on May 1st. We were talking before the break, and I'm curious to know what your thoughts are about people getting into therapy in order to help this process along.
I think that there's many different modalities, and I think every person has to make their own determination at different phases of their life about how they choose to get self-healing. I think there are times where therapy can be very helpful. I've been in therapy multiple times. And it's like something you can go into and stop and go back when you're going through a passage or a healing phase. And it's not the only way though. You know, there's some people do healing through meditation and chanting and yoga and those kind of practices. Some people do it through wilderness and adventure sports. There's not one size fits all, is my view.
Okay. I think you're right about that. And I think everyone has to kind of explore what works for them, what's a good fit. Step three is accessing the unity consciousness. Now, share with us your thoughts on how to open yourself to a higher level of consciousness.
Yeah. So the first half of the book is really about self-liberation and preparing ourselves or oneself to be as effective as possible when we're interacting with others. So this step, I think, is really important. And again, it's something that is a new concept for some people. Not everybody knows that there is this collective consciousness or unity consciousness that we can imagine or we can experience. And so the step three, I think, is really essential about accessing it's a mind state in my mind about understanding that we're all interconnected and that we connect globally with every life and all life, even beyond the human form. And so understanding that we can access that and we can then use that in our day-to-day lives, once you learn, okay, there's this thing called unified consciousness, then you learn, oh, I can access it. I develop the muscles to be able to access unified consciousness, then I can deploy it. So if I'm in a tough situation or I'm in a row with someone or something's going on, I have to learn to breathe and connect with that so that I can generate myself as my highest self in the most difficult circumstances. And I can see the whole picture. It's not just about me, it's about us collectively. So having that ability to tap into that awareness of our collectiveness is really critical.
And, you know, I think that's maybe something that people are exposed many times through their religious experiences, because you go to the community, whatever your religion may be, and there's a community. And I was always taught that the power of prayer magnifies and increases the more people who are involved in it. And it's so true, because so many times I can actually feel the energy sometimes from different people, from different organizations. And it's something to really focus on, isn't it?
I think it's essential, actually. And I definitely agree with you that prayer and religious spiritual activities can be a pathway, but I think it's universal for all humans. For example, when there's a life event, like if there's a birth of a new baby, or if there's the death of someone that you love, there's a sense of like a mystical awareness, a sense of being interconnected, you know, through the generations. Or if you have a medical crisis, there's a sense of a heightened awareness. When you're running or doing sports, you get like a runner's high, or there's something called nature mysticism. When you go to see the Grand Canyon or you see some beautiful thing, you get, oh, wow, that wow is what I'm talking about. That's a sense of unified consciousness. So I think everyone's had a taste of it. And I'm like, my intent is really to open it up and say, hey, this is like accessible, and you can use it to optimize, to live as a revolutionary optimist and to help transform our world.
Oh, yeah. And once people read your book, then they also have the opportunity to get involved in your movement. And that was just, it's just like it spreads it around. It's just everyone can share in this. It's a wonderful concept that you're exposing us to. I'm so happy to have you with us.
Yeah, thank you. I think you got it. You hit the nail on the head. The idea is to really connect love-centered people and to understand that we're all out there and we're not alone, and that we have to like stand up and reach out and connect.
Yeah.
And this is a time in our history where that could be really powerful.
Okay. Yeah. And then step number four, as we talked about earlier, peace crafting, healing the separation and conflict between people, organizations, countries. It's a very, to actually reach out to others and begin this peace and this loving process is an amazing experience. And I think a lot of people just don't know how to do it.
Exactly. And I've been, I've been learning myself, actually. So as I wrote the book and peacecrafting got more clear, you know, as I studied the literature and reviewed my own life experience. And actually, it was written over this past year when we were dealing with the war in Gaza and Palestine and how that affected me personally, my family, and all the divisions that we experienced. So it was like real-time learning. And then this four-step cycle that I shared about earlier is a way forward on that. And it works, actually. It's like spinning in my head now. Like, it's in there. It's like, and it works like if I'm at a family dinner and there's someone who's saying stuff that I react to, you know, I go, okay, can I be peacecrafting? Or when I'm in a Zoom call with activists and fellow activists in my work world, you know, and there's disagreements or there's conflict, how can I be peacecrafting, you know? So it works at all different levels. So it can work in a church or a religious setting or in a group setting or where people go to work every day to work. So peacecrafting, I think, has a lot of opportunity to help people. And it also talks about, like, how do you open yourself up to multiple perspectives? How do you review your own narratives and your own stories that are in your head and recognize that maybe they can evolve. Maybe they're not static. Maybe it's a dynamic thing that we can all like shift our narratives. And that can be hard and painful.
Oh, yeah. You know, I just, I'll share with you, I just turned 80 this year and I'm very aware. Oh, yeah. I'm very aware of the generational divides that we have in this country. And it's really hard. And I, my husband and I are trying very hard all the time to bridge the generational because the world our children and grandchildren are growing up in is so unbelievable. When I think back that my grandparents, they never flew, they barely left the house, and our children are now walking around with these little iPhones, and of course I love them too because I can ask all kind of questions and find out all kinds of things. It's like, hello, I need help. But there is a big division between the generations, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, intergenerational communication and peacecrafting, I think, is really important. I think there is a divide, and technology has created more of a divide, as you say. And we are living in this information and technology revolution, and it's actually moving so fast, and it's not going to stop, you know, for as long as we're alive, it's going to keep accelerating. So humans are struggling, actually, Dawn, how to navigate this changing lifestyle and this changing way of living. And so I really think it's important to be very mindful about, you know, technology and taking technology holidays and, you know, not using your phones while you're at a meal with a loved one, you know, all these practices that are hard. You know, you walk into restaurants and the kid's on a little screen and the parents are texting each other, you know, so people are not connecting eye to eye and heart to heart. And so technology holidays are something that can be part of a daily practice and or longer, and social media holidays too, because that's also a very divisive.
For sure. We had all of the, immediate family, all 17 were here for the last holiday. And when we all went out to this dinner at this long, long table, okay, I don't make many rules, but the one rule was phones on the table.
Right.
And we all have to talk to each other.
Yeah. One of my kids, you know, we have that rule sometimes as well. And one of my kids was like sitting at the table like this. And I'm like, hello, what are you doing? And they're like, I'm praying.
Oh, I love that.
So they I was just praying.
Yeah. And one of mine came back with, I'm doing research. And I said, okay, welcome to our world. We're not only going to talk to each other, we're going to try to listen, which is a concept that is new to some of them. It's amazing.
Right.
You know, we're going to take a break now, and I'm going to talk and share with you some priceless personalities like Dr. Paul who have been on my show previously.
Have you ever met someone who was unforgettable? Someone who has touched your heart and soul? People who have faced difficult problems? People who have struggled to find solutions? People who fearlessly shared their stories? People who have not only informed you, but inspired you? People who have priceless personalities? I have been fortunate to host an internet radio talk show called January Jones Sharing Success Stories. And it has been my privilege to interview hundreds of guests. My guests have shared their stories, their struggles, their secrets, and their successes in their own words. In this book, we're talking about people dealing with problems such as incest, molestation, runaway kids, child abuse, drug abuse, polygamy, unemployment, scandal, and starting over. Then there are my guests dealing with difficult physical struggles such as blindness, cancer, and birth defects that are beyond traumatic. My guests have all been exciting, eclectic, and energizing. They have amazed, amused, and even astonished me. I have adored getting to meet them, and I adore sharing them with you.
Attention all listeners, Priceless Personalities, Success Stories Shared by January Jones, Volume 2 is now available at Amazon.com in paperback and Kindle editions. You'll be able to meet 10 amazing people who will be sharing their own personal stories with all their struggles, successes, and solutions sprinkled with lots of humor and hope. Priceless Personalities features a teenager who becomes one of the famous Supremes from Motown, a nurse who as a humorist helps people to heal, an inspiring laughter yoga instructor, a mother dealing with the loss of a child, an incredible motivational speaker, a woman who married 5 times, a gifted paranormal nurse, a wise economist, a funny female humorist, along with an older man sharing his sweet childhood in the Deep South. January's guests are all amazing and amusing. You will never forget meeting them. Go to Amazon.com for your own priceless experience.
Welcome back with Dr. Paul Reitz, who is also a very priceless personality, and I'm so pleased to have you with us. Now, Paul, step 5 is a word I have never heard. It's something you must have created. I love it. It's imagineering.
Yes, actually, I want to give credit to Walt Disney. He actually created it.
Okay.
And I have adapted it and evolved it over the last phase of my life.
Uh-huh.
The way I describe it in the book, it's really about opening up your visions, doing radical imagination, unlocking political imagination as well about what's possible, and then translating those visions and that imagination into reality, manifesting it. So it's vision plus manifesting is Imagineering. And that is the idea in step five. Step five, I think, is the longest step because we go into really how do you unlock your vision. Your visions matter. Your ideas matter. The world that you want to create, whatever you have in your heart, we need to unleash that and release that and bring it into our experience and our dialogue and our conversations, wherever we're having them. And then by working in movements, by not doing it ourselves, you know, the problems are big, even at a local level, it's complicated. So you need to work with others and build movements of folks that want to align with you on achieving something. And that's what the second part of step five is about. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know, my personal mantra, and I've tried to share this with our family and my friends, is basically that if you can think it, you can do it.
Right.
And so many times people think, I hear this, oh, it's too hard. I can't do it. They're very negative. And you have to just step forward and change the narrative. And anything you think, you're actually capable of doing.
Yeah. So that's the inner dragon voice, that one, that voice that says you can't do it, or I'm too small, my voice doesn't matter. That's what we cover in step two as the inner dragon that needs to be healed, because what you're saying is true. Open up your visions and believe that you can help make them happen. That's what step five is about. Mm-hmm. And it's a very, it's fun, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, it kind of gives you the braveness to do things that scare you silly.
Yeah, exactly. That's. I thank you for raising that point, because bravery is contagious, actually. And I forgot to tell you, as a doctor, I feel like it's a responsibility and an opportunity to let you know that revolutionary optimism is highly contagious.
Oh,
and
good.
There is no cure and there is no vaccine for it. So it cures anxiety and despair. And once you have it, you know, sorry, you might have it forever.
Yeah. And you know, one of the other things I talk about in my book, Thou Shalt Not Whine, is the power of the smile.
Yes.
And basically, when I'm a smiler, you know, I smile whether I like it or not. One time I was recovering from surgery, and the doctor said I was actually in the recovery room smiling. So I can't help but not smile. I smile all the time, but some people have a hard time with it. And what I have found that if you put a smile out there, guess what comes back? Yeah,
it's a human biological reaction, right?
Yeah,
and also, if you ask people, instead of ask them how you are today, one of the things that optimists do is ask, what was the best thing that happened to you today?
Oh, I like that.
Instead of saying, how are you, which is like you have to go through, well, am I good or am I bad? Am I going to say fine when you're not really fine or whatever? And so another way of saying it is, what is the best thing that happened to you today? And that triggers the brain into optimism, like looking at your life as full, and what can I be grateful for, and how. So that's really an important practice as well, with smiling.
Yeah. Now, we have two more steps before we have to close out our visit. Number six, sparking peaceful revolutions. Where do you give people hints on where to look for practical tools and where they can go to join your revolution? What do they do?
Yeah, there? Yeah. Actually, step six is very practical. It's a very focused on, once you have imagined the new world that we want to create, and then you're working with others, you're building movements, love-centered movements, you're coming together on that, then step six is really about the tactic of peaceful resistance. And really, there are phases in history and time where you have evolutionary progress, and there are phases where you can spark transformational or revolutionary phases. So there's a lot of risk right now. We're at a crossroads where we can go down a path of destruction, or we can go down a path of repair and healing. And so I'm advocating for us to participate in peaceful revolutions to really transform the way that we're relating to each other and our earth, so that we can put love at the center of our social, economic, and political systems. And that is really what, and we go into, you don't always have, all you need is like 3.5% of the people on the streets calling for action, but you need another 25% of the population who's supporting them, giving them food, giving them housing, giving them money, or doing peaceful resistance from your desktop or from your office. So there's many different ways for people to participate, and not everyone has to be out there protesting or on the, in a revolutionary fervor. People do need to do that. So we talk about those kind of different roles that people can choose.
Yeah, again, you can slowly, quietly do it from the sidelines, and you don't have to be right on the front lines all the time.
Exactly.
This is a wonderful book for you to have written, because we are so desperately in need of hope. We're desperately in need of your message, which is peaceful revolution. And the thought of unifying so many diverse people, cultures, aspects, it becomes overwhelming. How were you able to accomplish this, write this book? It's amazing.
Yeah, so step 7 is unifying, and it really is the culmination of this journey. And really, revolutionary optimism, the 7 steps, it's like a journey. And it's like each step is a lifetime of opportunity for growth and transformation. It's not like you read this and all of a sudden it's going to, everything's going to be there. It's like an ongoing thing. So unifying is about 2 levels. One, unifying within yourself. Like really, what is your soul's purpose? What is your deployment? How do you want to serve at a macro, at a life level, you know? And really aligning whatever that truth is for yourself with how you're living your life. It's taken me a long time to actually do that, you know? And then it's about unifying around us. So interracial, interspiritual, intergenerational, interpartisan, international, you know, like all these ways that we can see each other as one and as connected. And it's like it's like you have to look at reality through those lenses of unifying. And then you start seeing things differently. Like, what would it be like if I put love at the center and I was unifying, as we talked about, intergenerationally? What action can I take if I wanted to create a dinner where I had boomers and Gen Z and, you know, all the generations, you know, and create a space for everyone to have a their voices heard? You know, that alone would be transformational.
What a wonderful world. Before we go, this is a question I ask all my guests. If you could have dinner with anyone living or dead besides me, who would you invite to be your dinner partner?
Oh my God, I didn't know that question was coming. I think right now, in the wake of publishing this book, I would have to say Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I have really been deeply immersed in his writings and his teachings and his love-centered activism. And I feel like revolutionary optimism is just like another iteration of his teachings, you know, for our time. And I feel like I could learn so much from him, and I could be so inspired by his wisdom and his clarity.
Wonderful. Yeah, that would be an incredible dinner party, and I hope you invite me too. So for now, I want to thank all of our listeners for entering with Dr. Paul and I into the No Wine Zone today. And please share our stories and his incredible book with everyone you know. And remember, right now, you need to stop whining and then start smiling and being optimistic. And if that doesn't work, then you can just start eating chocolate. Lots of chocolate. Signing off from the Glitter Granny and Dr. Paul Wright. Take care and stay safe until we meet again.
Thank you.
We want to thank you for listening to January Jones Sharing Success Story. Always remember Ms. Jones' personal mantra, if you can think it, you can do it. That's what all of our guests have done with their lives, and so can you. You are the ultimate success coach in your own life. All you need to do will be to start sharing your own story with your family and friends. We hope that our guest stories will encourage you to explore an equation in your future that will combine your creativity, plus connecting with others will enable you to be successful too. Always remember, your passion plus your purpose will equal prosperity as you explore the wonderful world of January Jones.